Can I just see for a few seconds who of you are married? Okay, two of us. Okay. Who of you wants to get married? Okay. that was a trick question, in case you didn't know. But I saw everybody bringing their girlfriends or boyfriends, and, you know, just to sort of, okay, afternoon night, dearie, let's just, you know, get this knot tied and whatever. Okay, well, some people, you know, have joked that marriage is sort of like, you can compare it with flies on a screen door. You know, those on the outside want to get in, and those on the inside want to get out. And but it's not, you know, it's not really that bad. It might be worse. the interesting thing is, I realize that something like marriage, well, actually, you know, singles and sex as well, you know, are both, you know, all three of these topics are extremely sensitive, and it's actually quite hurtful for some of us, you know, to talk about singleness and to talk about sex, and maybe even especially talking about marriage, because some of us that are sitting here tonight have been, you know, the recipients of our parents' wedding or marriage relationship, and some of it was very good and was very joyful, and some of it was, you know, was not so good. And so we ask ourselves this question. I have a longing to have a marriage partner, or maybe I don't really have it, but some of us do. And would it be worthwhile engaging in this thing that we call marriage? And the best place actually to go, well, I think before we go there, you know, many of us know that in South Africa, about 50% of all marriages end in divorce. Okay, let's start with the bad news. The whole rest of the evening is going to be good news, all right? But the bad news is about half of all marriages in South Africa end in divorce. That's mostly true in all other Western countries as well, the USA as well. When we look at the Christian community, how the Christian community fares, you know, when it comes to marriage, we actually don't, we don't fare any better than the secular community. Just for interesting take, in a Barna poll taken in the USA, if you take all married Americans, of all married Americans, 24% of secular of all married Americans, 27% that get divorced are Christians, and 24% are non-Christians. 24%. In other words, Christianity fares 3% worse than a secular people when it comes to marriage. Now, where do we go to, you know, look at what marriage is about? We've all heard marriage sermons, talks, and you know, we've been at camps and all sorts of things that that some of us were enlightened, supposedly, as what marriage should be about. But where do we go? We as a believing community believe that Jesus probably has a great deal to say about this, and he actually had a lot to say about this. So what we're going to start with is we're going to read the passage from Matthew 19. We're going to just read right through it. It's about 10 verses, and then afterwards we're going to have some comments on it and see what we can really get out of it. I really think if we look at this specific passage, I really think Jesus hits the whole issue of marriage. You know, he hits it on the nail, he really pinpoints what is really the problem and what is the solution as well. I really think that he does. Okay, so let's start. We're going to start with Matthew 19, and it says, "When Jesus had completed these things, he left Galilee and crossed the region of Judea on the other side of the Jordan. Great crowds followed him there, and he healed them. One day the Pharisees were badgering him, 'Is it legal for a man to divorce his wife for any reason?' He answered, 'Haven't you read in your Bible that the Creator originally made man and woman for each other, male and female? And because of this, a man leaves father and mother and is firmly bonded to his wife, becoming one flesh. No longer two bodies, but one. Because God created this organic union of the two sexes, no one should desecrate his art by cutting them apart.'" Of course, this is the Message translation, which is a very, very good translation. But it is a free translation as well. "They shot back in rebuttal, If that is so, why did Moses give instructions for these divorce papers and divorce procedures? Jesus said, Moses provided for divorce as a concession to your hard-heartedness. But it is not for God's, but it is not part of God's original plan. I'm holding you to the original plan and holding you liable for adultery if you divorce your faithful wife and then marry someone else. I make an exception in case where the spouse has committed adultery. Jesus' disciples objected. If those are the terms for marriage, we're stuck. Why get married? Good question. Okay. So if we look at what's going on here, the Pharisees was one of the four or five major parties in the first century, in first century Judaism. They were considered to be the conservatives. And it was, of course, asking these questions to Jesus is a way of trapping him. By the way, if you look at the New Testament and if you look at the gospel stories, one of the things that you did not do with your rabbi, if I'm a disciple of a specific rabbi and I follow him, I never challenge his authority in public. I never do that. I ask him questions in private where he can allude to some scriptures, where he can allude to some wisdom, and where he can really help me, and we can debate to and fro. But I never challenge him in a debate. Whenever someone challenges a rabbi in a debate, it's mostly with the purpose of humiliating him and challenging him or challenging his authority. That's exactly the same thing that's happening here in chapter 22 of Matthew. We get the same thing. The Pharisees look at the whole thing and they say, "Oh, so when the Sadducees couldn't trap him, the Sadducees and the Pharisees actually came together to actually see if they could trick him into saying something unpopular or something that they could severely disagree with." The same is happening here, and there's basically two reasons why this is a loaded question. I'm going to just go into this for a few moments because it actually already tells us something about marriage and about how the people in the first century saw marriage. So the first reason why this is a loaded question is Jewish marriage in those days were mostly based on Deuteronomy chapter 24 verse 1, which says the following: if a man marries a woman and then it happens that he no longer likes her because he has found something wrong with her, he may give her divorce papers, put them in their hand, and send her off. So the whole divorce law was basically based on this piece of scripture. What's important to note is the word used for he doesn't like her and he found something wrong with her had something to do with, we can translate it with being, it's things that are objectionable, something that's displeasing. The Afrikaans word is iets onbetamelijk. I think the Afrikaans, the 83 translation says, as iets onbetamelijks in haar gevind het. I can't even ask a brief here. Now, the important thing to notice here is this may sound very harsh, and it indeed is. It actually became harsher as the centuries went on. But in the first place, giving the woman or the wife divorce papers was actually for her protection as well. Because if you just send the woman off without any divorce papers, it means that she's actually legally still bound to this person. She can't remarry, but she doesn't have any place to stay. So she's homeless without the possibility of getting married again. So giving divorce papers was actually a way that the people sought to protect the woman by providing her with something in her hand that she can get married with again. Now, the whole polemic in first century Judaism on this specific issue was about this word, something I dislike, or something wrong with her, or something displeasing, or something objectionable. And there were several interpretations of this specific term or idea. There were basically two schools of thought. There were the schools of thought based on the Rabbi Shammai, and there was the Rabbi Hillel. And the Shammai guys said there's actually only one meaning to this: looking at her, looking at my wife, finding something objectionable, and that is sexual immorality. Very close to Deuteronomy 22, if you read that. In other words, a woman, when they get married, was supposed to be a virgin. So when you have sex with her the first night and you see that she wasn't a virgin, you can divorce her again. You can give her the divorce papers. Or if she might have been a virgin, but as the marriage go along, you found out that she actually cheated on you. That is the way that you can give her the divorce papers. So the school of Shammai basically said, only because of sexual immorality were you allowed, only on that basis were you allowed to give your wife divorce papers. But the school of Hillel, they translated it a little more loosely. They said you can find something objectionable in your wife when she overcooked your food, when she burnt your soup, when she spoke to a man in the street, when she argued in a voice loud enough to be heard by the neighbors. I just have to say, when I was just about 2001, we lived next door to neighbors. Our bedroom were next to theirs. I never saw this guy before they moved in. I never saw what this guy looked like or his wife. But I heard them, like, frequently. And they would swear at each other in the evenings, you know, when they've got something, you know, like a pot hop, and, you know, they got in a few drinks, and they would start swearing at each other. One evening, he was standing outside. He was actually on his way leaving, and she remained inside, and he was shouting into the inside of her, and she was shouting from the inside. It was terrible. It was the most creative combination of swear words I've ever, you know, heard in my life. And by the way, that guy came to Christ. I was sitting there one day, and I was preparing a sermon, and I sort of just thought of this guy out of the blue, and this is really not my way of doing any sort of evangelism. I never do this. I'm very relational in my discussions with people and very much open. But this specific evening, I just sort of, you know, I think God just placed something in my heart, and I went over to the guy, and I knocked on the door, and he let me in. That's the first time I ever saw him, you know, big guy. And we sat down, and I just, you know, said, thank you so much for your hospitality. Thanks for letting me in. I just want to ask you a question, you know. And please excuse me for if I'm sounding abrupt, but do you know Christ? And he started smiling, and he looked at his wife, which was not his wife, by the way, that they actually lived together, I found out. And he said, no. I said, well, you know, would you like to know Christ? He said, yes. I said, really? Do you want to get to know him right now? And he said, yes. And we sat at the table, and I drew him a little picture of how the kingdom works, and, you know, how the, and asked him, is this what he wanted to do? And he said, yes. I said, okay, well, cool, let's pray. And we prayed, and he actually came to the sermon, and he gave his testimony that evening. But anyway, you know, when I think of swearing, and a husband and wife, I only have this picture of Dave and his girl, and they got married, of course, and have lived happily ever after, you know. Luckily, I don't have any contact with them anymore, so I don't know. Anyway, and so the school of Hillel had all these loose interpretations, and they also believed if you just see a more pleasing wife, your own wife can become displeasing to you, and you can give her the divorce papers. Now, the school of Hillel, the more liberal view, was the dominant position in Jesus' day. Very important to note that. Okay, so if you listen to these, what school is Jesus from? It's not a trick question. He's from Shammai, all right? He's from the conservative school. He's from the school that says only because of idolatry, adultery, may you get divorced. Now, of course, so this first reason, this is one of the reasons why this was a trick question, because Jesus did not have a popular opinion, and they dared him to actually speak out. In terms of what he believed. Secondly, the second reason why this is a trick or a sort of entrapment thing is in verse 1, we read that he left Galilee, went to Judea to the other side of the Jordan to Perea. Now, if you look at the map that I brought you, it will appear right now. You'll see that we have the purple here, which is Galilee, and we have Samaria right here. And we have Judea. And Herod, in the most instances in the Gospels, when you hear the word Herod, King Herod, they usually refer to Herod Antipas, who had Galilee and this other purple part as part of his kingdom. So he had Galilee and he had Perea. The word Perea merely means the other side of the Jordan, which is not, you know, a really creative name. But anyway, this is where Jesus went. Now, what's important to note about this area is this area was particularly associated with Herod Antipas, and especially with the ministry of John the Baptist. We all remember what John the Baptist did. Okay, he confronted. What happened here is Antipas had a brother that had this part of the country, a brother called Philip. Philip had a beautiful wife, Herodias. And Antipas looked at her, and he saw that she was very beautiful, and he wanted to marry her. And she was also, then of course, his half-sister because of the fact that she was married to his brother. But that really didn't matter to him. I'm sure it messed up the family, you know, thanksgivings and so on. But anyway, he saw that she was beautiful. She actually liked him. They married, and, you know, he sort of suggested, you know, okay, so man, marry me, then you can be my sister and my niece and my wife, and we can live in a trailer and move to Benoni, you know, or whatever. But so they got married. And then, of course, John the Baptist confronted them in this area. He confronted them, and he called it adultery. He called Antipas' marriage to Herodias adultery. And she was very angry at this. And we know what happens if you look at Mark chapter 6. We see that she wanted to have revenge on John. And she had a beautiful daughter who could dance very well. And they, at one birthday party, they danced in front of all the people. Herod was so pleased with her, Herod Antipas, that he said, listen, this must have been one heck of a dance, because he told her, listen, you can choose, I'll give you half my kingdom. You know, ask anything you want from me, and I will give it to you. You know, not great impulse control, you ask me. She went to her mom, and she asked, you know, what should I ask of him? And she said, ask for the head of John the Baptist. And of course, Herod cut off John's head and bring it to her on a platter. And so this area, if you read geography in the New Testament, it's always for a reason. When Matthew tells us that Jesus came to Judea, he went across the Jordan into the area of Perea, what immediately comes to mind when people ask him anything about divorce or adultery, you know, they sort of ask him, okay, Jesus, so are you ready to say anything about divorce or adultery in the context of, you know, what happened to John? So this was really a very loaded question, or another reason, you know, why this was a loaded question. And they actually provoked him, you know, would you actually have the courage to go public? Like John did, and he lost his head for it. And Jesus said, yeah, I'll go public. It's a sin. If you divorce, that is not really God's way. And he doesn't go back to Deuteronomy chapter 24. He goes back to the very beginning. He goes to Genesis. And by the way, of course, this is important to say. This is not to step on the toes of people today that have really gone through divorce, that have been through very hurtful things. That's not at all the idea here. The reason why it's important to say something about divorce is just what Jesus is addressing here is, what is the nature of godly love? Godly love between a man and a woman is permanent. It's something that is inherently so holy and so deep and so valuable that to separate those two would actually to do something sacrilegious, because love is supposed to be something that is so extremely valuable and so extremely holy. And by the way, the Jews, very other than some of the Greco-Roman cultures around them, really saw marriage and even sex as something purely holy, which some of the Greeks did not. We spoke about that last time. Just interesting thing, in the Jewish world, a woman could not apply for divorce. Okay, only a male had that opportunity. But that was not true in the Greco-Roman world. In the Greco-Roman world, a woman could file for divorce. Like, for instance, the Herods, who sort of, you know, Herod saw himself as a Jew, but he was actually much more a pagan and a Greco-Roman than much more a Roman than anything else. Not by blood, but by sympathies and so on. In the Herod family alone, there were 9 divorces in that time. 9 divorces, and 5 of them were filed by women. So the women were allowed to file for divorce. Okay. So Jesus does not duck this question. He goes back to Genesis and he says the following thing. What was God's original intent when it comes to marriage? It's permanent, intimate, exclusive, joyful, mutual oneness. That's the purpose of marriage. And so the Pharisees thought, okay, ha, we have him because he went to the wrong text. You know, and we have him because he said something that was actually really unpopular. And then they asked him, a very important question. Okay, so because they were ready for any kind of answer that he would give. So if this is true, if love is supposed to be permanent, if divorce is supposed to be not a good thing, not according to God's will, and by the way, if we have to see this thing in context, just look, by the way, at how Jesus handled and approached all other people that were recipients of bad relationship and divorce and even adultery and so on. He handled them with extreme compassion, with extreme care, and he didn't judge any of them. By the way, that's a very interesting thing. The only people that Jesus ever judges are church people. I don't know if you know that. He only judges the church of his day, and never was any judgment cast on an outsider, on a woman, that was caught in adultery, and so forth and so on. But that's another talk, I think. So then they ask him, okay, so if this is so, if divorce is a wrong thing, why then did Moses in Deuteronomy 24 give the permission? And here Jesus really cuts to the heart of everything. He said, you know, it's not because that was the ideal thing. It was just because God was realistic. He knew that we have, in our fallen world that we live in, we have hearts that easily grow cold and that easily harden. And he was just making some room for the fact that that people could grow cold. But this was not really God's plan for the human heart. So God's gift to the human race is to inspire us to have tender hearts towards each other and to have sincere hearts. But in a fallen world, our heart could really get hardened. Now, some of you know, or I don't know, you might not, but in a marriage relationship, it's so very easy. And of course, I realize that I speak mostly to singles. I've actually told you this first time, that I'm going to talk about marriage, hopefully, from the perspective of a single. And maybe in that sense, I'm really not the best kind of guy. Maybe Johan should have done the talk, you know, since I'm not really single anymore. But I think the one thing that I thought that we can discuss tonight is, just to go back, it doesn't matter on which side of the fence that you're on, if you're married or if you're not married, to look at what was God's purpose and start there. And now, most of you who were recipients of some pain because of marriage relationship between mom and dad, Jesus says that the problem in any marriage starts right here. It starts in the heart. Very often it starts very well. The two are in love. They really like each other. They really love each other. He carries her books. He helps her with the dishes. He really do everything that he has to. And then they get married, and the years go by. And then sort of, you know, she wants him to move the couch. And he's like, well, lovey, don't do it now. Just wait until halftime, and then I'll move to the lazy boy, and then you can move it. You know, there's no, you know, hearts grow cold. And so Jesus is addressing here a thing that's very important, a thing that the Pharisees themselves were mostly guilty of, and that is the problem of the hard heart. Instead of seeking to serve, I seek to be served. Instead of seeking to confess, I blame. Instead of seeking reconciliation, I exaggerate the weaknesses of the other person. And the modern classic, you know, I married the wrong person. You know, I'm normal, you know, but I married someone who is actually not normal. We start the whole blame thing. And therefore, guys, if we want to prepare for marriage, this is one question that is so important, but that falls into a lot of categories. But it's this question: how's your heart? And it's especially important as how is your heart after you got hurt several times? Because there are several reactions you can get on that. Some people close up. If you close up after a relationship, when you got hurt, you're not really ready to get into something like marriage. You still have the longing. And many people do that. I close up. I still have the longing for a marriage partner, but I'm not opening up soon. It means that you are developing a hard heart. So my question to you tonight is, how is your heart? Is there tenderness? Was there forgiveness? Are you willing to work long term, not just after 5 years of marriage, but after 10 years and 15 years and even 20 years of marriage? And what's by the way, very, very interesting, just talking about this last comment, I married the wrong person, is social science have indicated that people tend to marry, not always, of course, there are exceptions, but people tend to marry, in general, more or less the person of the same level of mental health and stability as themselves. And the problem, Jesus says, is the heart. Therefore, I hate divorce. If you look after your heart, if you guard your heart, there is something to be done. Okay, so let's look just at a few practical things. I'm just going to have five practical things. Five ways how to cultivate a tender heart. How to cultivate the kind of heart that can survive and even enjoy the depth of marriage. The first thing is, remember that feelings follow behavior. This is very, very good news. This means that we should redefine the thing that we call love. People today think, you know, most people get divorced in their first 10 years of marriage. Why do they do that? They have all these expectations about what marriage is like, about love is like. They get married, and then after 2 or 3 years, she comes to him, "Lovey, I can't help it. I just don't feel anything anymore. My love is dead. I'm trying, but it's just not working." So in other words, the definition of love, it's a pure feeling. When the feeling had gone, there's no love remaining. Now, it's very important, very significant, and I think insightful to realize that in the Greek world, where there were four sort of general terms used for love. We had agape, which most of you would have heard of, okay? That's a sacrificial kind of love. Phile, very much the same, more on a friendship basis, but in the Greek-Roman world, or in the Greek world, and even the New Testament, those two terms are used interchangeably as well. So it's not very rigid, okay? Then you have the word sexus, which is, of course, it's the feelings based on the sexual differences between a man and a woman. And then you have eros, which is the word that we derive erotic from. In other words, it's the butterflies in the stomach, it's the lekker verliefde gevoel, you have the ooey gooey kind of feeling. Now, it's interesting to note that in the New Testament, the Old Testament, you know, does talk about it, but in the New Testament, the only two words used in marriage relationships are agape and phile. In other words, the same kind of love that makes a friendship work is the same kind of love that makes a marriage work. What does that mean? What does that entail? It means that marriage is not based on a feeling. And just remember, I told you the first time, I think, when we talk about singleness, the guys in these days, they didn't date, okay? Dating is like a modern invention. Those people didn't date. Your mom and dad decided who you get married to. If you love her or if you don't love her, it makes no difference. But strangely enough, most of those people learned what love was. Why? Because they had this friendship thing among them. They decided, we're going to do this. We're going to make this work. And here's the good news, says psychology does today. The feeling will always follow. By the way, this does not mean that the feeling is not important. Okay? But the basis, the definition of godly love is the kind of love that decides, I am going to love you. I'm going to stay faithful to you. I'm going to do things for and to you. I'm going to serve you. I'm going to give everything. And when you consistently do that, The feeling will always come back. Feelings do change the whole time. They go away, and they may even go away for a long time. They will always come back if you stay faithful. And here's a very interesting statistic. 80% of the people that said they were unhappy in their marriage said after 5 years they were happily married. That's very interesting. 80% of people that said they were unhappily married but stayed faithful said after 5 years, I'm now happily married. And then 16% of the people that said, I'm unhappily married and they got divorced, say afterwards that they're happy. And this was published in a book entitled, Does Divorce Make Us Happy? And it's a secular study. And the lady is, I've got her name here somewhere. Sorry, I'll get it just now. If someone really wants to know, I can give it. It's very interesting that this doesn't really happen. So, when your heart cools down, when you feel that things cool down, don't be alarmed, don't worry about it. You can stay sensitive, you can cultivate a tender heart, a tender, loving heart. How? By keeping on doing the right thing, although you don't feel it. Why? And this is taking Jesus' word seriously, because he says that love is supposed to be permanent. So make it permanent then. You're not a victim of how you feel. That's such good news. That's really such good news. It's in our hands whether we want to cultivate the love that can really come back or the kind of feelings that can really come back or not. So a heart that grows cold, we can inflame again. So continue to communicate the permanence of your love by things you say, the way you look to your spouse, and the way you touch. And by the way, it's important if you're married to sometimes touch one another without it leading to sex, because it communicates to the other person that it's not only about the sex, and it's just because I want to be. Okay, so that's the first practical thing. Redefine, you know, or the whole idea of remember that feelings follow behavior. And by the way, I've worked with this many, many times. People would get entangled in affairs. And I've got some affairs in my first church when I was very, very young. And, you know, you have two adults, people older than you, and they got into an affair, and you start wondering, shucks, okay, you know, I'm 20 what years old? You know, what am I going to say to these people? And I still remember this one couple. She was having an affair with another guy. And you know what? This was a great lady. I knew her before the time. She was actually part of the youth ministry, but a much older lady. And she was, this one morning, I just thought that I should phone her. And I phoned her, and she was crying on the phone. And I said, what's wrong? And I drove there, and she cried like for half an hour. And I was saying, what's going on? And then she let the cat out of the bag. I'm actually in an affair, and I don't know how to get out of it. And, you know, I don't really want to get out of it. I said, why not? What's in your relationship with your husband? And she said, you know, he's a great guy. I just don't love him anymore. I just don't have any feelings. It's dead. It's just not there anymore. And they're two beautiful daughters. And long story short, you know, through a lot of listening and a lot of talking, a lot of discussions, we decided that she's going to break off the affair with the other guy, and she's just going to serve her husband by doing loving things. And she committed to that. It was about 3 or 4 months later, she phoned me one day. I actually all forgot, because they didn't get divorced and they stayed together. And about 3 or 4 months after that, she phoned me. And she said, Rudolf, by the way, I just want to tell you, we spoke about this, but I just want to tell you, I'm in love again with my husband. And that's the good news. God can always bring back, if we respect the permanent nature of what God intended love to be, and we really work on that, we don't even see a divorce or leaving each other as a possibility. That really helps. And by the way, that's so important, not to even see it as a possibility. Because if you see it as a possibility, when it becomes too hard, it's very easy to take the possibility. But when you say to yourself, there's just no other option, we've got to make this work, you actually become, there's a tension inside of you that actually stimulates creativity. and can really help you solve your problems. Anyway, so that's one of the things. Of course, there are a lot of exceptions. You know, should I stay in a relationship where you are being abused? No. You know, get out of a relationship if you are physically threatened or whatever. Please ask me about that in the Q&A if you like. We don't have time for it right now, but we will have time for it in the Q&A. The second thing is, decide to love for the long haul. I've already said that. I'm not going to elaborate on that, but decide that you're going to love people for the long haul. And by the way, the interesting statistics is that 50% of people that married for the first time get divorced. 66% of people getting married for the second time get divorced. And more than 80% of people that marry for the third time get divorced. So we don't improve. All right? And many people think that that's, you know, if we just keep practicing, you know, I'll get better. I know a guy that lives in the States, he's in his ninth marriage. You know, it's just a, you know, it's an exception. But we seemingly do not improve as time go by and as relationships go by. So stick at who you choose and who chooses you. Okay, so the third one, having healthy conflict can really help you cultivate a tender heart. What do I mean by that? Conflict is really the arena, is the training ground for tender hearts. That's where you actually, you know, where you are pushed to the limits, where you test yourself as how serious you are about having a tender heart, about having a soft side for the other person. And of course, this example comes right out of the cross of Christ, right out of the conflict, politically speaking. The people crucified him, and he said, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they do." If you take that, what he had done on the cross, using those words, and you translate it into a marriage relationship, you've got a winning recipe. And research has shown us as well, and by the way, you can look at Proverbs 15, verse 1. A harsh answer flames up the anger, you know, a tender answer, you know, puts out the anger. Research has shown us that what happens in conflict is so important that can decide whether these two people are still going to be married within 4 years' time. What do I mean by that? They realized that couples that were, when they argued, when they lost themselves, and they say such hurtful things, it's much more difficult for them to really reconcile afterwards again. But if a couple could manage themselves and argue in such a mature fashion, because listen, you are going to fight, all right? And by the way, I'm saying here the presence of healthy conflict. The first thing I should say is the presence of conflict. I'm severely troubled by couples who don't fight. Because there are two world views that come together that differ very much. And the way you have conflict is extremely important. In other words, the research has shown us that if you can contain your anger, you can argue, but if there's a limit to the height of your anger, you will stay engaged in marriage much longer. But if you're someone that loses it frequently, and you say things you don't mean, and you use language that you don't mean, now of course, forgiveness and confession is a great way to heal the pain of the past, but it becomes much more difficult. So having self-control, asking God, you know, and even confirming our love while we argue. Lovey, listen, we haven't solved this thing. I know we disagree, you know, tremendously, but listen, I just want to say, I love you, and I'll never leave you. Okay, let's continue the fight. But to have a self-control, to give the other person the assurance that this fight is not fatal. It's just we're handling differences. It's just a way of solving things and getting to the other side. Okay, so the way we we handle conflicts very important. And people even suggested, have a timeout thing. If you're in a great argument and you feel, okay, here the emotions are climbing the ladder and they're climbing and climbing, one of you should just call timeout. Okay, well, timeout. Let's just stop now. All right. Let's just cool down. We continue this fight tonight at 6 o'clock. But now we just go. It literally helps if people could have the self-control to do that. Okay. And then the fourth one, this is so important to me. I wish we had time to have a sermon on each of these things. Create, by example, the feelings that would inspire the other person to become a person who have a tender heart. In other words, instead of dominating, instead of forcing, instead of manipulating, because if we see something in the other person that we don't like, and if we see something in the other person and the way she reacts towards me that I think is an unhealthy thing, what do I try to do? I try to preach her out of it. I try to, but this is not right. Try something else. Try having the conduct that would produce the feelings in her that would make her act differently. It, by the way, very much the same with children. If you're going to be parents at some time, and not like Johan, first having the kids and then the marriage thing. just remember this. Instead of asking, the bitch, can't you just think about what can I do to produce the feelings in her that would make her act differently? And man, isn't that exactly what Jesus did on the cross? He didn't wipe out his enemies and change them instantaneously. What did he do? He did something. He revealed his love on the cross to such an extreme extent that when you reflect on it, it changes us. It produces feelings of humility. It produces feelings of, whoa, I want to serve this man. I want to serve God. I want to give my best. If you really reflect on it, it changes you. That's the same thing. If you want someone else to change, you change first. And it's just not a nice cliche, Gandhi saying, become the miracle you want to see, But there's a lot of truth in that. There really is. And then the last thought. And that is vitally important if you're a Christian and if you want to be one, is reflecting on the cross of Jesus. Reflecting on the cross of Jesus. Why? Just think about it. Why is Jesus saying these words right now? Why did God allow in the Old Testament the whole idea of Deuteronomy 24, giving divorce papers and so on? Just think for a moment. Why is Jesus saying this right now in the light of all the other kingdom stuff that he has been saying all along? Because there was a... In the Garden of Eden, we already know that. There was the three relationships that got broken. Hardness of heart came into the world. It escalated later on exponentially. The world became a gruesome place to live in some respects. And during this time, God spoke to the people through some of his prophets. And through Ezekiel, he said the following thing. He said, for here's what I'm going to do. God is speaking through Ezekiel. He says, I'm going to take you out of these countries, he's talking to Israel, gather you from all over, and bring you back to your own land. I will pour pure water over you and scrub you clean. I'll give you a new heart. Put a new spirit into you. I'll remove the stone heart from your body and replace it with a heart that's God-willed, not self-willed. I'll put my spirit in you and make it possible for you to do what I tell you and live by my commandments. You'll once again live in the land I gave to your ancestors. You'll be my people. I'll be your God. This is God's purpose right through the Old Testament, is to recover, is to restore those relationships. It's to restore the relationship of himself with his people. How is he going to do that? He himself is going to give us the opportunity and the means and the tools through which we can actually cultivate a tender heart. And so Jesus has come into this world. In Matthew 12, he says when he drove out the demon, the fact that I drive out the demon confirms that the kingdom of God has come. The time is now. Now is a new day, he's saying, where it will be possible for you to have a new heart, to cultivate a tender heart. That's why I hung on the cross. He took out the heart of stone of his murderers with a heart of flesh. And Jesus saying, this prophecy that Ezekiel spoke of is happening right now through me. So I think he provides us with the tools that we can pray the following prayer. That he says we can pray, God, may your kingdom come in my heart. Forget marriage. Let your kingdom come in my heart. Help me forgive. Help me look at people with a tender spirit. Give me the heart that you have. And then let your kingdom come in my singleness. Let your kingdom come in my dating relationships. Let your kingdom come in my marriage. And as Tolkien said, we may conclude with the words, they happily lived ever after. Even through a messy relationship, even through a messy marriage. And I want to challenge you guys, don't get discouraged by a messy marriage, okay? You know why you're going to have a messy marriage? Because we're all messed up. That's why. But the power of God can work in and through us and use that messiness to create something beautiful and create something that brings life and can create something that produces great things. And may the experience that you have of marriage through your parents or whoever, or the uncle that you knew or whatever, may the pain that some of you have experienced, may it be healed through the words of Jesus, saying, you can have a tender heart. I'll help you cultivate that. And we do that the best, I think, when we look at the cross. And we follow him right there, even in our marriages. So, let's talk to God, and then we'll have time for Q&A. Lord Jesus, we acknowledge your presence. We thank you that you are here. We thank you that you make sense. We thank you that you pursue us, and that our hearts are the sole thing that you pursue all the time. Some of us have been running away from you, been hiding from you. Thank you for knowing that you love us, that you want the best for us, and that you give us, through the coming of your kingdom, you give us the opportunity to live lives with tender hearts that can grow in love towards one another. Lord, I want to especially pray for people tonight who are a little scared of marriage just because of what they've seen. And I want to pray that you will encourage them. I want to pray for those people that decide that they're going to stay single for reasons of their own, that you would guide them, that your kingdom would also come in their decision and in their singleness. We want to ask you, Lord, that you would use our marriages in this country to cultivate society in a way that they can really bring life. When I sort of made the joke just now by asking these folks whether they want to get married, a lot of them put up their hands, and so a lot of us want to get married. That's just normal. And I want to pray that you would provide us each with a future. That we would not be disheartened or discouraged by anything, that we would continue to believe in the power of your love. That can really, honestly, genuinely change people and deliver us from our own evil. Help us to be humble in our relational and social interactions. Help us to be transparent about our own weaknesses. Help us to serve each other. And whether we're married or not, help us, Lord, train us through whichever situation we find ourselves in, train us to have tender hearts, to forgive, to confess, to serve, to love, and to produce something great. We look to you to bring the fruit in our lives. In Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, guys, any, Jon, JD, Jon's going to send the mic around. Any comments, questions? There's one.
Hi, I've just got a question about the verse that you read in Matthew.
Yeah.
Specifically, because the word that the message that you used is that it's okay to divorce in cases of adultery.
Yeah.
Where some of the other translations use the word specifically sexual immorality.
Yeah.
Which imply, or I've heard an argument that sexual, if it was sex after marriage, in other words, cheating,
yeah,
then Jesus would have used the word adultery specifically. But he didn't. He used the word sexual immorality, which then means that specifically sex before marriage.
Yeah.
In the case, like you said, that it was considered acceptable for a man if he discovers that the woman is not a virgin on the wedding night or whatever, that he can divorce her there and then. Now, the argument I've heard is that it means only in that case is it okay, biblically speaking, according to what Jesus said.
Yep.
And I know this is a super loaded question because many of us have divorced, but I just want to know your technical sort of take on
on that. Yeah. Well, the word he uses is porneia, from which we get the word, you know, pornography. But I don't, you know, get stuck on that because it doesn't have the same kind of meaning today. Porneia is really a very broad, is actually a very broad term. I think it's a very appropriate word that he uses there. And the idea is that any kind of adultery, whether it's just sexual immorality, it could not be out of marriage or outside of marriage, because the context he talks about is within the context of marriage. So if you get married, the term that he uses makes room for both possibilities. You get to know her after you got married, you get to know that she's not a virgin and you can divorce her. Or you get married and she fools around, you know, and you can divorce her as well. So it's a very broad term that's being used. And people get very technical, by the way, about this word means this and that word means that. And I've often told people, you know, and I still do, you know, if people... If people tells you, you know, that this Greek word is very specifically only this, and this Greek word is specifically only this, be very, very careful, because words are used interchangeably all the time. So the context, and most commentaries would just say that it's any kind of sexual immorality, whether it be before marriage or within marriage. And by the way, this is a very important question, so thank you for that. Why then did Jesus still say that you can get divorced because of that? There are several reasons for that. Firstly, is the kind of emotional impact that comes into a marriage relationship once a person got unfaithful is sometimes so painful and so severe that it's just very, very difficult long-term for a person to heal very quickly. And the idea is actually to protect the innocent party here. I've been involved... I've been involved in several affairs. I've been involved with couples that have had affairs all over the place, and some couples really, in immaturity, get over it and they get healing. For other couples, they also get better, but it takes a lot longer because of their specific personality or whatever. So I think Jesus give that, I will also say, a kind of a clause, just to help people to at least temporarily experience the freedom to get healing before they again engage in marriage. So I hope I answer your question a little bit, but don't get stuck on the term. You know, read the commentaries, and you will see that it's quite a broad word that he uses. Okay, thanks, Derek. Dunke, can you mooi sien jou, Derek?
You say it's a good idea to develop good conflict management skills. As a single person, how would you say I do this? Do I choose a good friend and just start pushing his buttons? And, or do I look for a fight? Do I start one?
No, I think the good thing is you don't ever have to start looking for fights. Just don't run away from them. In other words, I think friendship, to cultivate friendship with honesty, is very important. Honesty is actually the big thing, where people can really honestly look at one another and say, you know, I disagree with that. I disagree even if you get to know the person very, very well. I disagree on what you did last night or what you said last night. It was hurtful to some people. So to cultivate mature friendships, to really learn to handle conflict is very important. And by the way, if you can learn to handle conflict in a friendship environment rather than the marriage environment, you know, if you only start to cultivate the skill in marriage, you're going to have a hard time. You can do it, but really try to cultivate the you know, or to be at home in an environment where honesty is a very high value and where people can really honestly disagree. And that's very rare, I must say. People in our country, even in academic circles, where you're really, you know, supposed to disagree severely, people are very, very touchy. And the interesting thing is, if you look at 1 Corinthians 1, Paul never says, well, I'm not talking about Pope Paul the second, but he really ever, you know, confronts people who are insensitive, although, of course, sensitivity is a part of being loving, but he does confront people about being touchy. In 1 Corinthians 13, he says, if you are touchy, if you get hurt easily, now hear this, if you get hurt easily, you're immature. It's not loving. Why is touchiness not loving? Because when I'm touchy, what am I actually saying to you? If you don't say what I like, I'm going to react. That's what touchiness is. So acquiring the maturity, it's really a character thing. So Derek, I think a long way to answer your short question is, just don't shy away from confrontation. And I think, you know, not all people like confrontation. And even in marriage, people handle confrontation in different ways. Learn to know personality types. You know, learn to know the different ways that people have been brought up. And try to cultivate a culture of healthy disagreement and conflict within your friendship circles. I really think. And do debates. You know, debating really helps you. But also realize some people, like, this is my wife, I like debating, you know. So debating is not me trying to be difficult. I'm actually to try to assimilate and see for myself whether what she said to me was really a good and a viable thing and a good way forward. So I debate because I have a point of view on this, so I test my own point of view, and if she can refute me, I'll take her position. But some people don't like to argue. So if you have a spouse, like some people do, that do not like conflict, your approach have to be much softer, and you have to draw the disagreement out of her over a long period of time. But what do you think? No, I'm fine. No, what do you really think? No, I'm fine. What, you know, cultivate the skill to draw it out of someone, you know, to get them to speak and say what they really think and feel. So that's very important. So anyway, people, this is a very important question. If we cannot handle conflict, my experience is many people can't, and it's because of touchiness and getting easily hurt, you know. So, yes, Derek, okay, just there's another opportunity, and then Derek, if you finish, you can ask a question again if you like.
Rudolf, you mentioned earlier about abuse. Now, I want to find out about emotional abuse and not physical abuse.
Yeah. That's a very tricky one because in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul talks about leaving the marriage because of desertion. Okay, if one of the parties, like for instance, he talks about the believer and the unbeliever. If the believer wants to leave, you know, let him go. Some commentators have interpreted that to mean desertion in a general sense as well. So if someone... emotional abuse can be just as hard as physical abuse. Okay? And if some of the commentaries commenting on 1 Corinthians 7 say, if someone is so abusive emotionally that he or she does not want to, there's absolutely no sign of progress, there's absolutely no sign of them wanting to better themselves, to improve, to be humble about the whole thing, they've actually, in a sense, deserted the relationship already. They're already emotionally deserted. Now, this is extremely difficult because people use this often as an excuse to get out of a marriage, to just get out of a difficult marriage. But emotional abuse can make a marriage impossible when they don't want to learn, it's just true to their nature to abuse. And they have seen a therapist several times. There is no improvement. There's not willingness from the one side. Many people do say, you know, if they're going to destroy each other, you have to make a choice which might be the best of two evils, you know, and get out of the thing. And by the way, we have to be very generous in our opinions when it comes to this. In Christian circles, conservative evangelical Christian circles, there are a lot of disagreement on this as to exactly. But I do not think, like for instance, I knew a couple. The husband was abusing her physically as well, and her friends, you know, just said to her, "Listen, you're suffering for the Lord, you know, so stay faithful." And I mean, he killed her. Now I do not think that is a biblical point of view. So, but. Emotional abuse, the reason that it's tricky is, when do you decide, you know, that this is really, there's no way forward? And there has to be, from the one side, absolute, rigid, you know, I don't want to go forward, you know, I don't want to do this. The track record is there, it's very clear. Then I think it's not the best thing, but it might be the second best. To get out of that relationship. Okay. By the way, there's a great book that Craig Keener wrote on this, on 1 Corinthians 7. He talks about all these things. He's a great New Testament theologian. Craig Keener, I think the title of the book is Marriage, Divorce, and Remarriage in the Bible. You can just read it. Yes.
I had a question that is, if you're in a married relationship with someone and they decide on whatever terms they want to divorce you that don't fall under sexual immorality on your part, or they just got bored, or the love is not there anymore.
Oh, yeah.
And you said you're willing to stick it out, and they aren't.
Yeah.
And there's only so much you can do, so you do get divorced. What are the spiritual implications on you? Because technically, wouldn't that be you now, if you get married to someone else, doesn't that fall under that whole thing of you're committing adultery against your husband, your first one, or whatnot?
Yeah, thank you. I think that's a very good question. And I think the spiritual implications on you is, I think 1 Corinthians 7 could be applicable on that, because it's actually a way of desertion. You are being deserted. And you are the committed one. You will take the person back any time. And I think when Jesus says in Matthew 16 and 19, he says that in Matthew 5 as well, the whole idea of getting divorced because of adultery actually implicates the same thing. The ideal is still to forgive and make the relationship work, okay? But you are allowed to let the person go. Now, you say, not in the case of adultery, but I think the principle is the same. If you're not the person that wants to get divorced and people desert you, I mean, there cannot be any spiritual implications for you, except, you know, the logical ones of, you know, dealing with your own singleness again, you know, and working through the hurt and the pain and so on. I hope it makes sense. Okay, thanks.
Ek gaan sommer daar so sny as hulle nie omgee nie. En al gee hulle om, gaan ek nog steeds daar sny. En guys, we I just quickly want to say that I know that I've never really said anything positive about Rudolf in front of him. I kind of wanted to ask him to leave before I can say anything positive about him. But he's really somebody who practices what he preaches, by the way. And I've just learned so much from him when he talks about these issues. So I can really encourage you guys. I actually think he absolutely hates it, which might be a good reason to do it. But if you want to make an appointment in terms of counseling in a relationship or stuff like that, I can really recommend this guy. He's got all the time in the world. He doesn't do anything. And he really shares some wisdom. One of the nicest things, and maybe he'll hate me, maybe not, for sharing this, but Marie and Rudolf are not the typical match. They are very much, from an outside perspective, incompatible. It's night and day. If you if you meet the two of them and you put them next to each other, you'll notice he's fat, she's small. There's just so many many differences, but they really make it work. And it's a lot of sacrifices that a guy like Rudolf needs to make. Obviously, Marie needs to sacrifice everything, but it's really a nice example of how it can work. So I can really recommend talking to this guy about this. Rudolf Mind Donkey for the DX. This concludes our relationship series. So if you are not relationshipped out, then make an appointment with Rudolf. Yes, speaker.